Starting, as I told you, I'm trying simply to figure out what's going on in the world in this time of crises.
Aren't we all?
We all do that, yeah. And we both have in common, not exactly, but we are both about the same generation, mid-late 60s, born in a period of time when the world...
Hey, I'm young. I'm only mid-50s.
Yeah, you're young, yeah, but yeah. You're born 69, I think.
Yeah, 69, is it? Yeah.
So,
you meant late 60s, born in the 60s. I think you meant like 60s now.
No. Born in the 60s, which means I think we are both in very different places under very different circumstances, but both shaped by the experience of the end of the Cold War. I mean, in West Germany, experiencing the fall of the wall, reunification, that feeling democracy has won. Now we can face the serious problems like cancer, climate change, solving technological problems. You were, of course, born in the Soviet Union, came to the United States as a Jewish immigrant. How did you, at the time, experience that move, and how did you see these United States you're living in now?
And this is on? We're,
this is on.
We're recording. Mm-hmm. Okay. Obviously for me, coming from a dictatorship like the Soviet Union to a democracy like the United States was, a life-altering event. And it took a lot of getting used to because, we forget how closed the Soviet Union was in the 1970s, where it didn't have access. There was no McDonald's, no basic consumer goods. It was really a different world. And so, coming to the United States was, as a very young person, was a revelation to me. And I became ardently pro-American because I became enamored of the freedom and opportunity provided by the United States, the way the United States has taken in countless immigrants, including my own family, and provided them with citizenship and opportunity and made them into Americans just like anybody whose family has been here for hundreds of years. And so I grew up in the 1980s and became a Republican at a young age, really molded by Ronald Reagan, saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, talking about the Soviet Union as an evil empire. That really resonated for me, this notion of America as a beacon of freedom in the world, as a champion of freedom. I saw it in my own life, and I saw it, around the world. So I tended perhaps somewhat naively to think of the United States as this tremendous force for good, and I really, I never grew up with much religious faith, but to the extent that I had any true faith, it was in the United States. It was this American religion that John McCain and Teddy Roosevelt and so many others have spoken about so eloquently. That was certainly the way I grew up.
Can you explain? That's an interesting term, religion, civil religion. What does it mean from an American perspective? I mean, I know it, for example, in France, where they, in the time of the French Revolution, really transformed Christian rituals and symbols into civil religion, religious symbols. What was it for you in the U.S.?
Well, I think the American religion is really based on the ideals of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and basically creating a nation based on the idea that you don't have to be of a shared blood as long as you share the same beliefs, the same ideals. Now, to be an American, all you have to do is to believe in the idea of America, in our rule of law, in our democracy, in our checks and balances, in our individual liberties. That's what makes an American. It's obviously quite different in a lot of ways, although Europe is changing as well. But, in a country like Germany or France or Britain, it's difficult to be considered French, British, or German unless your family actually has been there for 1,000 years. Whereas in the United States, we're a nation of immigrants united by this belief in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And those were really the foundational beliefs that shaped my life. And I think in the 1990s, I felt like they were being vindicated with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the spread of liberal democracy around the world. I felt like American ideals were conquering the entire world. And so that was a time of great optimism and great idealism.
Mm-hmm. And Ronald Reagan, of course, was a central figure for that feeling of life, for that political feeling of life. You just said you wrote a biography on him, which will appear later this year.
Yes.
And you wrote in another book or said it was cool for you to be for Reagan. What did that mean? How was it cool being for Reagan?
Well, I mean, I grew up in the 1980s, and I felt like, I was growing up in suburban Los Angeles. I went to school at UC Berkeley, so I felt like I was always being surrounded by progressives, especially, teachers and professors who had been coming of age in the 1960s and really shaped by the ideals and influences of the 1960s. And I felt like I was part of this young counter-reaction to that, embodied by Ronald Reagan, that we were, these conservative revolutionaries challenging this decaying liberal status quo. And I should hasten to add, I view the history very differently today than I did then, but that was how I saw it as a very young person, as this immigrant from the Soviet Union growing up in the land of opportunity.
Yeah, and obviously this, of course, fits into a certain picture of the role of the United States as a superpower in the 20th century. You also wrote a book about this figure, Edward Lansdale, key figure in the Vietnam War, because who's so interesting, because he depicts that image of the United States as a benevolent superpower, a superpower that tries to make the world a better place and then fails and fails again.
Right. Yeah, I think that's certainly the case, that the United States has always been afflicted by the large gap between its ideals and its actual conduct. And I think as a young person, perhaps not surprisingly, I tended to focus more on the ideals and to see the U.S. as this tremendous force for good. And now that I'm older and more disillusioned, I tend to see kind of the limits of American power, which, we saw obviously in a very brutal way, not only in the Vietnam War, but also more recently in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I have to say that I'm losing a lot of faith in the United States, period, not so much because of its conduct around the world, but because of what's happening internally within the United States. I mean, I certainly could have never imagined growing up as a young Republican that the Republican Party and indeed the entire country would be captured by a malevolent buffoon like Donald Trump, who speaks to the very worst of human nature, plays on bigotry and hatred, and is utterly unfit to be a dog catcher, much less president of the United States. And yet, despite everything that's happened, I mean, to me, one of the most astonishing and dismaying facts about the United States is that even though Donald Trump has been twice impeached, even though he has been guilty of inciting an insurrection, of trying to overturn a U.S. election, he has committed, in other words, the worst crimes that any political leader can commit against the United States. Despite all of that, he still has the support of roughly half the population and could very easily defeat Joe Biden in November. That says to me something dismaying and terrifying about the political culture of the United States. And, so I've had to rethink a lot of my naive earlier ideals in light of the realities that I've seen revealed in the last few decades.
You said it was a takeover, the party, the Republican Party you knew you were a part of, taken over by Trump and the Trumpists. But when you look back at the time when you were active as a journalist, as a prominent columnist in outlets like the Wall Street Journal or the Weekly Standard, which was so important for the new conservative movement, was that a completely different party and movement? Or where do you see, in hindsight, maybe the roots of what we are seeing today?
Well, I've been grappling with that very question for a number of years now, and it's a central question in my biography of Ronald Reagan. To what extent is Trumpism a continuity, and to what extent is it a change from what the Republican Party was before? And, you know, at the risk of sounding like a typical academic, I would have to say there is both continuity and change. Clearly, there is a lot of continuity in that beginning in 1964 with Barry Goldwater's nomination, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party basically switched positions on civil rights. You know, between the 1860s and the 1960s, the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, was the party of civil rights, and the Democratic Party was the party of segregation in the United States. All that completely changed in the mid-1960s when the Democrats embraced civil rights and the Republican Party became a party of basically white grievance, is what it really amounts to, of white backlash against civil rights laws. And unfortunately, Ronald Reagan was part of that. That was a lot of the reason why he became governor of California and president of the United States, because he figured out how to skillfully leverage, you know, white backlash politics in a way that was not as threatening as George Wallace or others who were open segregationists. He certainly was not, but, you know, he knew how to dog whistle. He knew how to appeal to white anxieties, and he opposed all the civil rights laws of the 1960s and 1970s. And so, you know, I think in some ways, Donald Trump, you know, comes out of that legacy, because I do think that racism has been a central part of his message, but he's also taken it much farther than Reagan or any previous Republican has done, because he's been much more open about it. And also, I would add, you know, although Ronald Reagan certainly appealed to white bigotry, he was pro-immigration. The idea of NAFTA, the idea of combining the economies of the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, that was Ronald Reagan's idea from 1980. And of course, it's anathema to the Republican Party today, which has embraced nativism and xenophobia and protectionism. So there are, you know, some major differences, but there's also, unfortunately, I think there is a lot of continuity. And I think basically the big picture of the Republican Party, as I now see it, with the advantage of historical hindsight, is that basically ever since the 1964, the Republican Party has been drifting further and further to the right. You know, Ronald Reagan was well to the right of Richard Nixon. And now Donald Trump is well to the right of Ronald Reagan. And in fact, you know, now the Republican Party, you know, as embodied by Trump, is becoming not so different from the Le Pen Party in France or the AfD in Germany or these other far right-wing, radical, quasi-fascist, racist parties. That is basically what the dominant leadership of the Republican Party today embodies. So I think that is a change from what the Republican Party was all about in the 1980s. But you can see how we got from there to here.
Mm. Of course, Ronald Reagan was an extremely controversial and polarizing figure at the time. I also experienced that in Germany. I mean, for us, it was also cool to be pro-Reagan, and for a large part of my generation, Reagan was a dangerous figure. Where would you say, as well in hindsight, was he by his critics at the same time simply recognized in these dangerous aspects you just described, and where was he mistaken?
Well, the paradox of Ronald Reagan is, as I've discovered it, and I've spent the last 10 years studying his life and writing this biography, the paradox of Ronald Reagan is that he was very radical when he was out of office. He was very far to the right in his rhetoric when he was out of office. But when he was actually in office as governor of California for 8 years, as president of the United States for 8 years, he was actually pretty pragmatic and centrist. And so I think people didn't understand how pragmatic and centrist he would be, because, you know, much of what he said on the campaign trail was very frightening and very far to the right. You know, he in the 1960s, he was basically saying that the Democratic Party was leading America to communism, very much the same message that Donald Trump delivers today. And in the 60s, Reagan was saying that any social welfare legislation like Medicare and Medicaid was a communist plot to take over America. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that the John Birch Society was saying in the 1960s. The most far crazy conspiracy mongers, you know, kind of the QAnon of the day. And so there's a reason why people were scared about Ronald Reagan, and he was very confrontational in his rhetoric to the Soviet Union. But if you actually look at his record in office, he raised taxes more often than he cut taxes as both governor and as president. He cut deals with Democrats. He didn't try to overthrow elections. And ultimately, he ended the Cold War by working with Mikhail Gorbachev, not by confronting Gorbachev, but by working with Gorbachev and understanding that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist leader. That's not something anybody could have anticipated about Ronald Reagan, but it was a product of his streak of pragmatism and his desire to be a successful president, nurtured by Nancy Reagan, his very influential wife, and a lot of the great aides that he had around him, like Jim Baker and Colin Powell and others. So he was a much more centrist figure in office than he appeared to be based on his campaign rhetoric. I think the difference with Donald Trump is he has governed just as crazy and right wing as he is on the campaign trail. And I think this is actually, there's a profound trend there because, you know, Reagan was not so unique in what he did. He was actually typical of a lot of Republican leaders, including Richard Nixon, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush. They all threw red meat to the base in the course of their campaigns, leading Republicans to think that they were going to be really far to the right in office. But in fact, they were not. You know, Nixon created the EPA and OSHA. He was actually in many ways a pretty centrist president. George H.W. Bush raised taxes to reduce the budget deficit. You know, George W. Bush undertook this massive spending program to combat AIDS around the world. And so a lot of Republican voters were disillusioned by their leaders because their leaders turned out to be a lot more centrist and moderate once in office than these Republican voters had been led to expect. And I think a lot of these Republican leaders, including the ones I worked for, John McCain and Mitt Romney, knew that there was this isolationist, racist, xenophobic tendency within the Republican Party, but they basically ignored it. They refused to cater to it. Whereas kind of the political genius of Donald Trump is he caters to it. He unapologetically embraces the worst aspects of the Republican Party and doesn't just embrace them on the campaign trail. He actually governed in a way that made the most right-wing Republicans very, very happy. That's the secret of his success. And that's kind of the break from the Republican Party of the past. Instead of resisting the base, he is giving in to the, if I may use a pun, he is giving in to their most base desires.
Mm-hmm. Would you say in the path of that long development, of that long shift of the Republican Party, there were moments where people could have reacted differently and maybe stopped it, maybe turned this movement in another direction? And I mean people inside the party. You said there was an ignorance. People could have seen, they should have seen maybe. But also the critics, should they have reacted differently to what they saw and what they saw as a danger?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a long line of failure on the part of Republican Party leaders dating back to the 1960s. I mean, I think the original mistake of the Republican Party was basically in 1964 embracing Barry Goldwater, an opponent of civil rights legislation, over Nelson Rockefeller, who supported civil rights legislation. That was the foundational choice of the modern Republican Party. And I think everything since then has grown out of that. But, you know, if you look at more recent times, there was certainly a lot of lost opportunities on the part of Republican elites to do more to combat Trump and Trumpism. I mean, you've seen it. This is one of the most dismaying things for me. You've seen it in 2016. You saw it in 2020. You're seeing it today. Even though most Republican leaders know that Donald Trump is nuts, they know that he is completely unfit for office, that he is a disgrace, very few of them are willing to say so publicly, and even fewer of them are willing to embrace the alternative. How many prominent Republicans endorsed Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden, or will endorse Joe Biden this year? Very, very few. That, to me, is a disgrace and a failure, because if you're not willing to support the alternative, and by the way, both Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden are very reasonable, centrist people whose policies I'm totally comfortable with, and I think a lot of Republicans of the past would have been completely comfortable with, But nevertheless, most Republicans are still putting their party loyalties above their loyalty to the country. And I think that is what is enabling, or what has enabled, the Trump takeover of the party. And at this point, it may be too late because the party may be too far gone to be saved.
Mm-hmm. But I was also looking at the other side of the aisle. And this, of course, is something we are also discussing in Germany. Liberal centrist politicians, the media, public radio and TV, like we, how should we react to these developments? We also see, of course, in Germany, right-wing parties, populist parties getting stronger and stronger, racist speech becoming normalized in the society. And, of course, we have all these discussions you also had in the United States. Are we exaggerating? Should we take into account that people want to hear that? Should we talk about what we describe as the worries of normal people? How should we address that? So which mistakes were made on this side in the United States, and what could we learn from that?
I mean, I think that, as I said, I think the big mistake is the failure of the Democratic forces, small d, the failure of the Democratic forces to unite against the illiberal challenge that we are facing. Now, I think if you look at what happened in, you know, what's happened in France, when Le Pen gets into the runoff with Macron, all of the responsible parties unite behind Macron. They don't say, you know, it doesn't make any difference. They understand it makes a difference whether Le Pen wins or not. I don't know if that's happening in Germany or not, but I know it's not happening in the United States. As I said before, you're not seeing responsible Republicans uniting with Democrats to say, okay, we have our policy differences, but we are united in defending our rule of law, our democracy, our Constitution, and Donald Trump and his movement threatens our democracy. So we'll talk about our policy differences later after Donald Trump is united. You haven't seen that happening. You've seen a very few people. Liz Cheney is one who's done it, but very, very few. And I think it's that division among the opposition that allows demagogues and would-be dictators to come to office. And I think it's very, very dangerous when we put our petty political squabbles above the good of the republic.
I wanted to talk to you with you about the role of the United States in international politics, as a global superpower, and talking about that, we have to look back a bit in history, and I think we have to talk about 9/11, which was such a formative event for the world, for U.S. politics in the world, also for you. You, at the time I mentioned it, was a columnist on the neocon side, and of course it's easy to say in hindsight mistakes were made, it was a wrong decision to go into Iraq, but there were also at the time arguments that this is a unique chance to spread democracy all over the world. How would you describe these arguments from today's perspective? What was the best of these arguments,
I think what happened after 9/11 is that a lot of Americans, including myself, we fell prey to a combination of alarmism and hubris. The alarmism, of course, was because we had suffered the worst terrorist attack in our history, and we felt we wanted to lash out and to make our country safe. And we saw, you know, that the Taliban were hosting Al-Qaeda, so we went into Afghanistan. But then there was also this turn, this pivot to Iraq and Saddam Hussein, even though they had nothing to do with 9/11. But this was, you know, a longstanding issue dating back to the Gulf War in 1991. And there was a sense we wanted to eliminate danger, but also a sense that the ultimate quote-unquote solution to Middle Eastern terrorism would be the promotion of liberal democracy. And a lot of people, including myself, thought that by overthrowing Saddam Hussein that we would start this democratic wave in the Middle East that would transform the region. Now, in hindsight, I think this is ludicrously hubristic, but I think this was the mindset at the time, and it took me and I think the whole country many years to be disabused of these illusions and to be reminded once again of the limits of American power.
What were the moments where you realized this is something wrong is happening. This might be hubris.
Well, I mean, I saw it, you know, during the course of the Iraq War. I mean, I was, you know, very troubled by the abuses at Abu Ghraib. And I even wrote a column, you know, saying that Donald Rumsfeld needs to step down as Secretary of Defense, which caused a lot of people to give me the evil eye on the right, that I was turning against an icon of the conservative movement. And I think very belatedly, George W. Bush realized that something was going wrong, and he changed policy and changed commanders, changed secretaries of defense, and started to stabilize the situation in Iraq. But, you know, at the end of the day, it became pretty obvious that the costs of the Iraq War were far outweighing any benefits that we might accrue. And in fact, as many critics predicted before the invasion, you know, the primary beneficiaries of the invasion have probably been the Iranian mullahs who have expanded their influence in Iraq. And so, you know, I now recognize that I and about 70% of the American public supported this disastrous war. But it was really, I think, in some ways, the miscalculation of Iraq grew out of the unimaginable success we seem to be having in the 1990s. There was this sense, well, you know, communism has fallen, liberal democracy is triumphant, liberalism and democracy have spread all over Europe, they're spreading all around the world. So there was kind of a sense that, you know, why should the Middle East be immune from these trends? And in hindsight, I think there was an obvious failure to recognize that there were very deep-rooted historical forces at play in the region that were very antithetical to the expansion of liberal democracy.
And now it's exactly these experiences, these lessons that drive America, or at least the Republican Party and Trump, in the opposite direction, in
isolationist. Right. It's driven a lot of the Republican Party in the opposite direction to an extreme, because, you know, to me, the lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan is that, you know, the limits of American power, the limits of American interventionism, but the lesson is not we should become isolationist and stay home and, you know, let the world do whatever it wants. I think American power is still incredibly important. I think, you know, the opportunity to support Ukraine in particular is incredibly important, because the Ukrainians really are fighting for liberalism and democracy and freedom in a way that we only imagined we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they're actually doing it, and they're not relying on American or European or other foreign troops to do their fighting for them. They're doing the fighting themselves. All they're asking for is to provide the equipment they need to save their own country from a Russian invasion. And yet, at least half the Republican Party and much of its leadership has turned against Ukraine and is really embracing the kind of isolationism that defined the Republican Party before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. That, to me, is extremely dismaying. And it's a complete, if it's linked to Iraq and Afghanistan, it's a complete overreaction. But I think you can also link it to much deeper historical forces. As I said, this is basically the Republican Party reverting to its pre-World War II roots. You know, I think that's a very disturbing development, not only for the United States, but for all of our allies and indeed the entire world.
How do the discussions, do the current discussions about China fit into this picture? I was, and I am again and again, surprised to see how focused debates in America, not only in politics, but even more in foreign policy, academia, think tanks, are focused on these, on the struggle between the new two superpowers, the United States and China. Is it exaggeration? Is it a realistic approach to a new world order?
You know, I worry about our hysteria about China. I mean, there's no question that China is the largest challenger to American power in the world. There's, you know, their economy is almost as large as ours. Their military is not as strong, but it's you know, growing at a very rapid rate. So, you know, we should be concerned about Chinese power, but I'm concerned that this is one of the few things that Democrats and Republicans agree on these days, and there's kind of a race to show who can be tougher on China. There's, and that can lead to, I think, to kind of war hysteria and lead us into a dangerous place. In a lot of ways, I see parallels between where we are today and where we were in the late 40s, early 50s, in the early years of the Cold War, because, again, the Soviet Union was undoubtedly, it was a real threat, but there was also a tendency to exaggerate the danger. And, of course, you had unscrupulous demagogues like Joe McCarthy taking advantage of this actual threat to claim that, you know, everybody he didn't like in American political life was a traitor and a communist agent. And you see a lot of the same things going on today. Democrats, you know, are routinely accused of being communist agents by the Republican Party. It's quite alarming. And of course, you know, the Democratic response today, as it was in the 1950s and 60s, is to show, no, we can be just as tough on China as you are. And of course, that was the mindset that led us into the Korean War and then the Vietnam War. And so I'm concerned that, you know, we're talking about getting tough with China, and we should be deterring and containing China, no question about it. But we also need to be trading with China. We also need to be maintaining, diplomatic ties and relationships with China, and to try to get that balancing act right. And I think, you know, that's what Joe Biden is trying to do, but he's getting a lot of criticism from the right for being supposedly too soft on China. And I think that can potentially lead us into a dangerous spot where we could potentially blunder into a catastrophic war against another nuclear-armed superpower.
When we are now talking about the dangerous spots in the world, there is, of course, the new war in the Middle East. And it was interesting to see that the U.S. president, in a remarkable way, after the attacks of October 7th, traveled to Israel and warned the Israeli government not to repeat the mistakes America made after 9/11. How did that resonate with you? As somebody, as I mentioned, of Jewish descent, and who was always very supportive of Israel and Israeli politics.
I mean, I think Joe Biden has been doing the best he can in a very tough situation where he has limited influence. I think his instincts are the right ones. He is instinctively pro-Israel, pro-Zionist, in a way that most younger Democrats are not. He's of an older generation. But while he's instinctively pro-Israel, he also recognizes that Palestinians have legitimate grievances, and that the only way that you're going to have long-term peace is with the two-state solution, the establishment of a Palestinian state, which is something that Bibi Netanyahu and his far right-wing cabinet refused to recognize. And unfortunately, what's happened in American politics is that support for Israel, which used to be bipartisan, has, like, along with everything else, has become very polarized and partisan. And so Republicans are 110% pro-Israel, and they embrace, the most right-wing factions in Israel. Ron DeSantis, you know, said a day ago that he would be fine with the ethnic cleansing of the Gaza Strip. This is, you know, not just pro-Israel, but really embracing the far right in Israel, whereas a lot of progressive Democrats are pro-Palestinian and turning against Israel. And I think Biden is trying to find the center ground, which may not exist, but I think, you know, his views are basically where I am, which is pro-Israel, but anti-Netanyahu, and in favor and recognizing that Israel has a right to defend itself, Israel has a right to exist, but it also needs to make a reasonable accommodation with the Palestinians, which is something that this far right-wing government is not willing to do.
But what you're describing here as an American phenomenon, this polarization and this debate, is obviously a global phenomenon. I mean, we are seeing it in Europe as well, that the Middle East conflict, that Israel becomes something like a new line of divide between a left and a right, which reaches, I mean, it's also in Europe, in Germany, the most right-wing parties claim to be the most loyal defenders right. of Israel, and that means Netanyahu's Israel.
Right, but it's actually a very strange phenomenon, because these far right-wing parties often embrace white nationalism and anti-Semitism, and yet they're also ardently pro-Israel. So, you know, how do you be anti-Semitic and pro-Israel? I don't know, but that's a real phenomenon.
Obviously allows them to cover up their own anti-Semitism, and being in that way pro-Israel allows you to go against Muslims and leftish liberals.
Right. No, I mean, I understand that it's happening, but it's at some deeper level, it's somewhat bizarre and contradictory. But yeah, that is the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you at the end of our conversation, it it was so impressive. I read your book about the corrosion of conservatism and the Republican Party, and I was so impressed by your self-reflection, by your ability to critically reflect on your own journey in your political thinking. This is rare. We don't see that very often. Maybe particularly in journalism, it's rare. What enabled you to look back in that way on your own intellectual journey? What are the preconditions to be in that way openly self-critical and reflective?
Well, I have a two-word answer for that, and those two words are Donald Trump. I probably would not have reached this degree of self-reflection if it had not been for Donald Trump's shocking victory in 2016.
Well, but there must be something in your head, in your biography, that enables you to react in another way to Donald Trump and to the phenomenons you're talking about than so many other Republicans.
That's true. I mean, I'm not sure what it is exactly, because you have seen a real divide among Republicans where and conservatives, where most of them have gone along with Trump and Trumpism, but there have been some, you know, outstanding exceptions. You know, people who are friends of mine, like Bill Kristol or Jennifer Rubin or others, who have been, you know, very much as appalled as I am by Trump and have turned against the Republican Party that embraced Trump. Now, you know, what leads people to make these different decisions? Very hard to say. I will say that I think that some of the most anti-Trump conservative / Republicans, a lot of those people are minorities, whether they're Jewish or Mormon or something else. They're a little bit out of the mainstream, whereas, you know, especially kind of mainstream Protestants and Catholics in many ways have embraced Trump and in his political movement. But that's a theory. I don't really know why. All I know is that me personally, I know I was just so appalled by Trump from the second that he went down that golden elevator in 2015 to announce his presidential run, you know, by denouncing Mexicans as rapists and murderers. And then, you know, a week or two later, he attacked John McCain for having been captured as a POW. So, you know, everything he said, I thought, was just so beyond the pale of acceptable discourse. And I thought he was just such an idiot, such a buffoon, such a racist. I couldn't imagine how anybody could think he was fit to be president of the United States. So I was shocked, deeply shocked, to see the Republican Party, the party I'd been a part of my entire adult life, embraced Donald Trump, and then the country embraced Donald Trump. And that really caused me to rethink a lot of the things that, a lot of my basic assumptions about the world, in a way that I probably would not have done if Mitt Romney had been the Republican nominee.
And now, facing the possibility that Trump will be once more the president of the United States, how do you prepare for that possibility, and how should we, as Europeans, as Germans, as an audience, prepare for that possibility?
Well, me personally, I'm wondering what country I can apply to for political asylum. I'm not sure that I want to be part of the United States, led once again by Donald Trump. I mean, it's very hard to prepare for an eventuality as dire as that.
Do you think a new Trump presidency would immediately affect your work here in an independent think tank?
Oh, it'll probably take a while for him to get to me. I'm sure he's got other enemies that are much higher up on the enemies list than I am. But, I mean, there's no question he's going to go after people that he views as critics, and he will use all the powers of the government in a way that we've never seen any U.S. president do. I mean, he's basically running on a platform of destroying U.S. democracy, talking about terminating the Constitution, getting retribution against his enemies, you know, destroying the rule of law, firing the entire civil service. And unfortunately, he can do a lot of these things. It's never been done before, because previous presidents have been restrained by precedent and tradition and by the rule of law. But if you have a completely lawless president who doesn't care anything about the rule of law or the constraints on the presidency, unfortunately, I think he has a lot of power to do damage. And we'll see, you know, we'll see if our institutions hold, whether they will survive a second Trump presidency. You know, I honestly don't know, because he's going to be much more dangerous the second time around, because the first time around, you know, he didn't know how to make the government work, and he was surrounded by the, quote, adults in the room, kind of standard Republicans who saw their job as being to restrain Trump, whereas the second time around, he's not going to appoint anybody like that. He's only going to appoint people as crazy and as lunatic as he is. So I think it's a very dangerous moment. I don't know if U.S. democracy will survive. I'm pretty sure that, unfortunately, I don't think NATO will survive. I mean, he said he's going to destroy NATO. That's basically one of the first things. And he can do that very easily. He doesn't have to even formally withdraw. He just has to say publicly what he said privately, which is, I'm not going to defend these freeloaders in Europe. That's what he believes. He's not going to do it. You know, he's going to abandon Ukraine. He's going to embrace Putin and Russia. It's, you know, just such an unimaginable catastrophe. I just have to, I'm not a religious person, but I just have to pray that that doesn't happen and that enough of the American people come to their senses before November to avert this catastrophe.
Other countries or governments, of course, can't simply apply for another citizenship. So the German government is trying to prepare for that possibility. Foreign Minister Baerbock in last fall was in Texas trying to reach out to Republicans to meet people in order not to be surprised when it happens, what nobody wants to happen. Is there a way of preparing on a political level for that? To whom could they reach out?
I honestly don't know. I mean, there's no real alternative to the United States as the defender of the West and the guarantor of world order. I think the only real alternative is very easy to state, but very hard to do, which is Europe has to step up. Europe has to dramatically increase its own defense spending so that it finally ends its dependency on the United States. And, you know, that the United States of Europe finally become a genuine superpower in the world, which they certainly have the potential to be. But as a European, I don't need to tell you that this is unlikely to happen, given the political divisions that are still very much a part of the European continent. So, you know, in a best case scenario, I think, you know, Europeans would try to fill the gap in the way that, for example, Chancellor Merkel filled the gap to some extent as the leader of the West when Trump was in office. But there's a limit because, you know, Germany does not have the power of the United States. And, you know, it would be nice if Europe would show a greater degree of unity, but obviously that's probably not going to happen. So, you know, I think the most likely consequence if Trump wins again is going to be much greater, is going to be the end of the Pax Americana, the end of American global leadership, which is already in jeopardy, and a much more chaotic, multipolar, much more dangerous world where there will be, you know, much less resistance to the designs of dictators like Putin or Xi Jinping or the leaders of Iran or North Korea. That's not a world I want to live in, but I think that's the world we would be in if Trump wins.
And we maybe somehow have to prepare for it. Max Boot, thank you.
Thank you.